somehow shape the future. I would hope and pray I'd touch lives by the way I live today. Just one life. I want to leave a legacy. Years from now they'll see that I live only for the cause of Christ. Oh, to make a difference.
Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the Legacy Podcast, equipping you to build a legacy. This episode is number 223, and this is going to be an exposition from Esther chapter 1, which is a message I recently brought to the church in which I pastor, Mount Tabor Baptist Church. My hope is that in posting these messages that I am preaching regularly, that you will be able to build your spiritual worldview so that you can pass on a legacy of faith. And that's part of living in an abundant legacy and equipping yourself for that legacy. I'm believing is that be able to pass on a spiritual legacy is probably the most important. I have wanted to, of course, post a lot more material on the Legacy Podcast related to other aspects of legacy building as well. But for the sake of time, I've been able to. Of course, if you go over to thehomeschoolhope.com, you'll find my newest podcast, and that deals with interviews with people who are homeschooling, and that goes along also with passing on to the next generation what we can by way of homeschooling. So you might be of interest to that. Before we actually listen to the exposition of Esther chapter 1, I do have a couple of announcements. First of all, if you're not a registered user, I encourage you to do that. There is links in the show notes as well as on the webpage itself on how to do that. Secondly, if you are not yet subscribed through iTunes, that's the best way of being able to identify how you can or being aware of any new shows that come out. And when they come out, you can do that through iTunes, as well as that helps the rankings of the Legacy Podcast move up in the iTunes store. So I appreciate you doing that. So there's a link in the show notes on how to do that, as well as on the webpage itself. And if you'd like to support the show, the Legacy Partner Program is the best way to do that. And I won't go into a lot of detail on how you can do that, but you get some items that might be helpful to you in your marriage and in other areas of life if you become a Legacy Partner and you're also able to support the show. And then finally, visit those affiliates that we have endorsed on our webpage and in the show notes, and that also helps support the show. So thank you all for listening, and thank you for sharing the show with others. And with that, here is an exposition of Esther chapter 1.
Have you ever done something to show off? And what were the results? I have to admit that, especially when I was younger, I did it a lot, and never with good results. In fact, one time when I was at the University of Arizona, I was out on a bike ride with this girl. All girls are always involved, you know. And so I was out with this girl. We were doing a bike ride on my mountain bike, and of course, we were outside of Tucson, Arizona, all desert region, right? And so I get off the road and I say, "Hey, watch this." Always bad words when you say that. So I said, "Hey, watch this." So I went off down into the little gully and started out onto the desert sands. You know, I started going back and forth and I started doing this kind of deal, you know, with my bike. Well, I turned a little bit too much with my front tire. And guess what happened? My tire stopped, my bike stopped, and I went flying over the handlebars and landed in the desert sand. She was really impressed. And needless to say, I broke my wrist and scarred up my face. You can still see some of the scar on my face from it. And it was pathetic. Isn't that the way it normally turns out when you try to show off for somebody? Well, that's exactly not the exact same situation, but the exact same results. A disaster occurs in Esther chapter 1. As a result of a man who showed off, or tried to show off, and ended up with some bad results. I love the book of Esther. I just want to give you a little bit of context so that we can kind of find out where we're coming from and better understand what is taking place. The book of Esther actually occurs historically between Ezra chapter 6 and Ezra chapter 7. Land of Israel has been taken over already 200 years earlier. The northern part had been taken over by the Assyrians. And then 100 years or so after that, in 586, Jerusalem was destroyed in the south. And so the land of Israel was destroyed. And as a result, the people were in disbursement. Many of them had gone among the Babylonian Empire. The Babylonian Empire had fallen to the Medo-Persian Empire, which was situated in what is basically now Iraq, Afghanistan, Iran area, you know, the central Middle Eastern region. And this was all then resulting in some of the Jews under the Medo-Persians able to go back to Israel and repopulate the part of the Promised Land. And so some of them have gone on to repopulate Israel. Some of them remained in what was now the Persian-Median Empire in the Middle East. And the context of the book of Esther takes place there. It does not take place in Israel. It actually takes place in Shushan and other places around the Medo-Persian central capitals. And there are several themes that we can identify in the book. One is the sovereignty of God, although it's the only book in the Bible where the name of God is not mentioned. And yet we will see that the hand of God is involved in every detail of it. We also will see the deliverance of the Jews and the great theme of God's providential care and deliverance of the Jews time and time again. We'll see the centrality of the law, particularly as it relates to the Medo-Persian Empire and their laws. And then finally, we will also see another theme that reoccurs over and over again, and that is the theme of justice. Now, we see the setting in verses 1 through 9, and I think it's interesting that this first chapter follows the typical literary structure of a setting, and then there's a stress, and then there's a search for a solution of that stress, and then there is a final solution and a new situation. And we will see that followed out here. In verses 1 through 9, we see the setting, and it says in verse 1, "Now it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus," this was the Ahasuerus who reigned over the 127 provinces from India to Ethiopia. There was 127 of these provinces. They were incorporated into 20 different regions that each had governors over them. So when it talks about the governors and the overseers, these were the people who were in charge of each of those regions. And underneath those 20 regions, there were then these 127 provinces. And it's interesting how it's described here, because it says it spreads from India to Ethiopia. It actually went up into Asia Minor as well, which is now what is called Turkey. But interestingly enough, he does not record that. And that is probably because shortly after chapter 1 takes place, Ahasuerus ventures to that region to fight the Greeks and suffers a humiliating defeat and comes back with his tail between his legs to Shushan. And we'll find out about that a little bit more as we get on in later chapters. Ahasuerus himself was a Hebrew transliteration of the Persian name. And I'm going to probably butcher this name because I don't speak Persian or can't pronounce it. It's a bunch of syllables. But it's Kasherasha, something like that. In Greek, we know him as Xerxes, X-E-R-X-E-S. And he ruled from 486 to 465, and the events of Esther took place somewhere between 483 and 473, so about a 10-year period of time during his reign. And it says in verse 2, "In those days when King Ahasuerus sat on the throne of his kingdom, which was in Shushan the citadel." Shushan the citadel was also called Susa, and it was one of the four capital centers, and it was the residence for his winter home. And so it was probably in a more climate-tolerant area than some of the places in that region. And in verse 3, it says that in the third year of his reign, he made a feast for all of his officials and servants, the powers of Persia and Media, the nobles of the princes of the provinces being before him. This was, again, in 483. And the Persian and Media Empire, Cyrus the Persian inherited the Median Empire, and it became the Medo-Persian Empire in about 550 B.C., so that's about 30 or 50 years, I'd be 80 years or so before this took place. So it's been there a little while. And then in verse 4, it says, "When he showed the riches of his glorious kingdom and the splendor of his excellence, majesty of many days, 180 days in all." So he has this huge party for all of his officials in the region. He gets them all together and they celebrate for 180 days. And it says the reason for this is he wants to show off his riches and his glorious kingdom. It is a citywide feast. And I think it's interesting to note the opulence here. It says, "And when the days were completed, the king made a feast lasting 7 days for all the people who were present in Shushan, the citadel, from great to small, from the courts to the gardens of the king's palace." So not only was there a 180-day feast where he had all of his officials. Now, I don't think he had a 180-day total feast with all of his officials. Probably what happened was that he celebrated with each of them sometime throughout the time because they had to rule some. And so but he called them in probably periodically, some from each region, and celebrated this for 180 days. He wined and dined them. And then when he finished with his wine and dining of all the rulers for 180 days, it says that for 7 days he held another feast. And this feast, all the people of Shushan were invited. So this is not just the rulers, but this was all the people in the citadel, all the people in that city who were called to this feast. And again, he is showing off his excellence. And it says in verse 6, "There were white and blue linen curtains fastened with cords of fine linen and purple and silver rods and marble pillars, and the couches were of gold and silver, and the mosaic pavement of alabaster, turquoise, white and black marble." I mean, this was a luxurious feast. It goes on in verse 7, "And they served drinks in golden vessels, each vessel being different from the other." You know how much work that, this is like a customized drinking goblets. Each person had their own particular drinking goblet they would use in their parties. This was significant. "With royal wine in abundance according to the generosity of the king." So he is having the party of parties here for his people. And he is just, he is going all out for them in having this party. Verse 8, "In accordance to the law, the drinking was not compulsory." Well, that's a good thing. "For so the king had ordered the officers of his household that they should do according to each man's pleasure." I don't know how many of y'all have been in the business world, but sometimes when you're out with your boss in the business world, they they might go out for after hours or something like that, and it's kind of expected that if you go out with them, you're expected to drink like them. And it's nice when you're not required to, and that's what the king was doing here. But no doubt, there was a lot of drinking that was taking place. We'll talk about that here momentarily. So the king has this huge feast. Verse 9, Queen Vashti also has a feast. It says she also made a feast for the women in the royal palace, which belonged to King Ahasuerus. So he's holding the feast for all of the dignitaries, all of the uppity-ups of the kingdom and all the people who were rulers and authorities and all the oligarchy around him. And he's having this great feast. And his wife also is having a feast for all their wives and all of the women who were influential in the kingdom. And I think it's interesting to note here that He is much like many rulers of today in that this was probably what I would call a congratulations party. You know, when someone wins an election, what do? They hold a big election bash, right? A big party for their elections campaign. And they have all the people that helped on the campaign and everybody that helped them get elected. They have them over and they have, you know, this big celebration party. And that's kind of how I picture what's going on here. He's only been a ruler for a couple of years. And this is his time to really show him how great a ruler is going to be and how generous he's going to be as a ruler. And then in verse 10 through 12, what we see is the stress taking place. And so it says in verse 10, "On the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine." Well, there's a problem right there. We'll get to that momentarily. But it says, "On the seventh day, when the king's heart was merry with wine, that he commanded Memhuman, Biztha, Harbona, Bigtha, Abagtha, Zethar, and Carcass, 7 eunuchs who served in the presence of the king Ahasuerus, to bring Queen Vashti before the king, wearing her royal crown in order to show her beauty to the people and to the officials, for she was beautiful to behold." So it wasn't enough for him to show his opulence and all of the fine curtains and the golden goblets and all the stuff that he was doing and all the wealth of the kingdom. He said, look, you have not seen half of it. Wait till you see my wife. And so he says, hey, you eunuchs, go get my wife. Tell her to come out here and show her beauty to everyone. Now, it's we don't know exactly why she refused. There is some speculation. The way that the wording reads here seems to indicate that what he was asking her to do is to come wearing only her royal headdress. Well, as you might imagine, that would, of course, be a humiliation to the greatest extent that he was going to show off his wife in such a way. Others say that she refused because she was pregnant, actually, with Ahasuerus' son. And she didn't want to come being pregnant. We don't know exactly why, but it is interesting to note here that it says in verse 12, but Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command brought by her eunuchs. Therefore the king was furious, and his anger burned within him. So she refuses. So then what the question is, What does a ruler of the greatest and most powerful empire do when his wife says no? Well, he gets his counselors together. He says, we got this problem. My wife said no to my request. What are we going to do? Well, that's what we see in verses 13 through 15. It says, then the king said to the wise man who understood the times, for this was the king's manner toward all who knew the law and justice. So he gets his wise men together, those who studied the culture, studied the times, studied the trends that were taking place. These were the advisors, if we had them today, they would be the people on CNN saying, well, you know, I really think that the president ought to do this. And, you know, if he doesn't do this, then the people, you know, these are the kind of guys that he's gathered around him. Verse 14, those closest to him being Karshem, skip over all those names. You can read them there yourself. Seven princes of Persia and Media who had access to the king's presence and who ranked highest in his kingdom. So these are his great advisors. Verse 15, what shall we do to Queen Vashti according to the law because she did not obey the command of King Ahasuerus brought to her by the eunuchs? So he's posing the question that he's wanting to know himself. What should we do? She broke the law. She didn't come to me when I called her to come. So what are we supposed to, what's the law say to do to her? Verse 16, Memucan answered before the king and the princes, Queen Vashti has not only wronged the king, but also all the princes and all the people who are in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus. So he's basically saying, look, this is not just a problem with you, king. What Queen Vashti did goes beyond just a personal problem in your marriage. The example she's setting is going to be spread throughout all your whole kingdom. Verse 17, for the queen's behavior will become known to all the women. Uh-oh. What kind of example is she setting for all these women? So that they will despise their husband in their eyes when they report King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought in before him, but she did not come. We can't have that. We can't have an example of the first lady rejecting the king. What will the women do? So verse 18, this very day, noble ladies of Persia and Media will say to all the king's officials that they have heard the behavior of the queen. Thus, there will be excessive contempt and wrath. Now, whether or not the contempt and the wrath will be because they are angered by the request of the king that would call such humiliation upon Vashti, or whether they will be angered and furious because the fact that they are having to subject themselves to their husbands when their wife, I don't know. All the context of why it says here that there will be contempt and wrath. But the bottom line is to know the rulers were scared. There might be rebellion among the ranks. And not just the rebellion of the men, but a rebellion of the women. How tragic would that be? And so verse 19. If it pleases the king, let the royal decree go out from him and let it be recorded in the laws of the Persians and the Medes. Now, what's important about the law of the Persians and the Medes, and we'll see this over and over again throughout this book, is that the laws of the Medes and the Persians, they had a particular point about making their laws, and that was they were irrevocable. when they passed a law, it could not be overturned. You know, in the United States, we have a way by which we can amend the Constitution. And it's done that. We've had laws that were passed, and then we've had laws that were nullified. If you look in the amendments to the Constitution, you'll see that. And there was no way, really, of doing that among the Medes and the Persians. When they passed the law, that was it. That was particular about that land. And I think they probably did that in order to cause stability within the Persian Empire. They looked at the times past, one ruler raises up and he overthrows the laws that the previous ruler had. And they said, we can't have that. We've got to have consistency throughout our kingdom. And so they have this, that no law can be overturned. So continuing in verse 19, it says, so that it will not be altered, but Vashti shall come no more before King Ahasuerus, and let the king give her royal position to another who is better than she. In verse 20, when the king's decree, which he will make, is proclaimed throughout all his empire, for it is great, kind of brown nosing there, all wives will honor their husbands, both great and small. And the reply pleased the king and the princes, and the king did according to the word of Memucan. Then he sent letters to all the king's provinces, to each province in its own script, and all every people of their language, that each man should be master in his own house and speak in the language of his own people. So that's the first chapter of Esther. What are some themes that occur in this chapter that we can draw some principles or some lessons that we can learn from? Well, first of all, we see the extravagance of the oligarchy. We see the extravagance of the oligarchy. By oligarchy, I mean the rule of the few. We see this, and he gathers around all of the officials, the governors of the various provinces, and he has them all over for this party, and he shows the opulence that he has. And this was a time period when the Medo-Persian Empire was the strongest in the land. The Greek Empire in the West was surfacing, and as I mentioned earlier, later on defeats the Medo-Persian Empire. But right now, they are the strongest. China had a little bit of an empire in the east. But for the most part, King Ahasuerus' kingdom was it. And he was showing it off. The oligarchy was then and is today well connected. In verse 3, it says, all the officers, the servants, the powers of Persia, Media, the nobles, the princes, these were all well connected in Ahasuerus' day. And what did he do with the well-connected? Well, he has this huge feast, opulent feast, 180 days of feasting. That's a serious, serious feast. And then a seven-day feast for the whole city. How do you get the resources to do something like that? Well, you're part of the oligarchy. That's how you do it. And that's how he was able to do it. This is the problem with the oligarchy. They live in opulence at the expense of others. Now, I have no problem with people who serve well to get compensated through the free exchange of goods becoming wealthy. But I do have a problem with the wealth of those who get it by being a part of the ruling class. And this is what it says in Judges when the nation of Israel got frustrated. And they said, look, we no longer want judges to rule over us. We want a king, like all the other nations, to rule us. And what did God say to the people of Israel when they said that? This is what it says in 1 Samuel chapter 8. Then all the elders of Israel gathered together to come to Samuel at Ramah and said to them, look, you are old and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now make us a king to judge us like all the other nations. Now therefore heed their voice. This is God speaking. However, you shall solemnly forewarn them to show them the behavior of the king who will reign over them. So what should we expect? This is the question. What should we expect by the oligarchy? What should we expect by those who rule over us? Well, here it says. And he said, this will be the behavior of the king who will reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them for his chariots and to be his horsemen. And some will run before his chariots. He will appoint captains over his thousands and captains over his fifties. He will set to plow his ground and reap his harvest, and some to make weapons of war and the equipments of his chariots. He will take your daughters to be perfumers, cooks, and bakers, and he will take the best of your fields, your vineyards, and your olive groves, and give them to his servants. He will take a tenth of your grain of your vintage and give it to the officers and the servants. He will take your male servants, your female servants, your finest young men, your donkeys, and put them to work. He will take a tenth of your sheep, and he will be and they will be your servants. You see? What was the repeated phrase there? He will take. He will take. He will take. He will take. Have you ever asked the question how the oligarchy, the ruling class, gets all the abundance that they do? How was King Ahasuerus able to have a 180-day feast and then open up the city's coffers for 7 days to the city? How was he able to have that kind of opulence? It was by taking from those who produce. When we look at the opulence of kings or rulers, we must remind ourselves they got that opulence by taking from someone else. Governments do not create their own revenue or wealth. They take it from someone else. That's important to remember as we come upon times of election and we wonder if our government is going to do something. The only thing that they can do is take from some and give to others. So the first thing then is the opulence of the oligarchy. Second thing that we can notice as a theme is the abuse of power. It kind of goes along with number one, but it's separate, and I want to look at it a little bit differently. I want to emphasize two ways in which there was abuse of power here in chapter 1 of Esther. First was the demanding humiliation from his wife. One should never humiliate another. Some understand that humiliation is actually a breaking of the sixth commandment, because the sixth commandment, of course, is the you shall not kill. And when someone is killed, their blood flows differently, to say it nicely. And when someone is humiliated, either their blood all rushes to their head or it rushes away from their head, right? We call it either they're embarrassed and so they get red-faced or they get white-faced, right? And the idea is their blood runs unnaturally. And so some have correlated that in some ways to killing someone. And really, if you think about it, humiliation is that. It is taking away their life in some ways. And of course, he is asking his wife to be extremely humiliated here. We must think twice before we ask someone to humiliate themselves. It is better for us to humiliate ourselves than to ask someone else to be humiliated. And then secondly, we must notice here the using of force to control fear. The advisors to the king were afraid that the wives of the land were going to be rebellious to their husbands if something wasn't done to counteract what Vashti had done. So what did they do? They controlled the fear with force. This is what all governments do. They became afraid that the people might decide for themselves what health care to have, and so what do? They pass a law mandating certain kind to have. They fear that they will be free to decide what they want to drink on their own. And so the mayor in New York decides you can't drink oversized drinks and passes a law saying you can only drink so-sized sodas. Rulers, by and large, despise freedom. That's why the freest countries eventually pass more and more laws and becomes less and less free. Good government should only be out there in order to protect the liberties of individuals under their rule. Power is used to serve, not to be served. Jesus is the ruler of the universe, and yet listen to what it says in Matthew chapter 20. This is in the context of two of his disciples coming and asking to be first in his kingdom. And what does he say? He says, "You know the rulers of the Gentiles lorded over them, and those who are great exercise authority over them, yet it shall not be so among you. But whoever desires to become great among you, let him be your servant. And whoever desires to be first among you, let him be your slave. Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many." Oh, how great it would be if the ruling class of the day would heed that advice, but sadly instead, they are like ruler classes that came before, and they abuse their power. What is the saying? Power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. I pray that if you are in any position of authority, that you do not abuse that authority, but instead use that authority in order to serve. And then thirdly, the third theme here is the theme of marriage. And we see a couple of things negatively, and then one maybe positively. One is marriage is not about objectification. It seems as though Ahasuerus was looking at Vashti more as a plaything or as a trophy than as a wife to be cherished and loved. 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 7 says, "Husbands, likewise dwell with them in an understanding way, giving honor to the wife as to the weaker vessel, and as being heirs together of the grace of life, that your prayers be not hindered." You know, it's a sad state when men look to women simply as objects. Our culture is awash with objectifying women. You can't watch a TV show without seeing commercial time and time again objectifying women. And how tragic is that? This is not what marriage is all about. Marriage is about giving of yourself. Also, marriage is not about conditions. You don't put away your wife when she disobeys you. And yet that's what Ahasuerus did. He took the advice of the counselors and he said, okay, well, if she's going to disobey me, that's it. Done away with. The Bible says the two shall become one flesh. And what God has joined together, let not man separate. And marriage is not about force. The advisors did not have a good understanding of marriage. Why do I say that? Well, they were eunuchs, first of all. But secondly, they didn't understand marriage because the advice that they gave doesn't understand marriage. Because if you have to pass a law to make your wives respect you as husbands, there's a real problem. You can't force a wife to respect her husband. In fact, by forcing it, you're actually doing just the opposite. Why doesn't God pass a law saying that everybody has to love him? Because it's not from the heart, is it? It would be by force. And he wants us to willingly love him. And that's the relationship that he models or is a model for the marriage relationship. As a church, we are to voluntarily love the Lord. And a wife is to voluntarily love her husband. It's not supposed to be an issue of force. Yes, the Bible tells wives to submit to their husbands for order in the home because husbands need that. But husbands who have to keep telling their wives that they need respect or to respect them, maybe should be focusing more on being respectable than demanding respect. Ephesians chapter 5, verses 22 and following says this, "Wives, submit to your own husbands as to the Lord, for the husband is head of the wife, as Christ also is head of the church, and he is the Savior of the body. Therefore, just as the church is subject to Christ, so let wives be to their own husbands in everything. Husbands, love your wives just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for her, that he might sanctify and cleanse her with the washing of water by the word, that he might present her to himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that she should be holy and without blemish. So husbands ought to love their own wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself, for no one has ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, just as the Lord does the church. Nevertheless, let each one of you in particular so love his own wife as himself, and let the wife see that she respect her husband." Now, should there be a New Testament law saying that wives have to obey their husbands, and if wives don't obey their husbands, they're supposed to be put out of the church? Should there be a law saying that? No. Why? Because it would be by force. That's not real love. That's not real respect. I think it's interesting to note here what Article 18 of the Baptist Faith and Message says. A lot of people had problems with this when it came out, but I think it's a good statement, and I'll emphasize why here in just a moment. But Article 18 of the Baptist Faith and Message on Marriage says this, "The husband and the wife are equal worth before God since both are created in God's image. The marriage relationship models the way God relates to his people. A husband is to love his wife as Christ loved the church. He has the God-given responsibility to provide for, to protect, and to lead his family. A wife is to submit herself graciously to the servant leadership of her husband, even as the church willingly submits to the headship of Christ. She, being in the image of God, as in her husband, and thus equal to him, has the God-given responsibility to respect her husband and to serve as his helper in managing the household and nurturing the next generation." The reason why I think that is a good statement is because it says here the church willingly submits to the headship of Christ, and it uses that as a model for the way in which the wife is to willingly submit herself to the headship of her husband. Force does not belong in marriage. So what does that mean? No manipulation. How many marriages have manipulation in them? Well, I'm not going to do this until she does this, or I'm not going to do this until he does this, or because she did this, I'm doing this, or because he did this, I'm doing this. That's manipulation. It's games. It shouldn't be there. "Let us, brethren, not use force in marriage. Instead, let us voluntarily and willingly do as we ought. If we're unwilling, then ask God to have a change of heart so that he might change us." And then number four, we see the negative influence of alcohol. You know, he called to humiliate his wife due to alcohol. It says that when his heart was merry with wine after feasting for 7 days, he called his wife. He was under the influence when he did it. Now, I wonder if his situation would have changed had he not been under the influence of alcohol. It says that Vashti was very beautiful. She was obviously carrying his child. There was a relationship there of some way. And yet, because he was under the influence of alcohol, he made a stupid decision to try to humiliate his wife. Would he have agreed to do that if alcohol was not a factor? This is why it says in Proverbs chapter 31, verses 4 and 5, "It is not for kings, O Lemuel, it is not for kings to drink wine, nor for princes intoxicating drink, lest they drink and forget the law and pervert the justice of the afflicted." You know, alcohol impairs good judgment. Do we even need to go there? I mean, isn't that just a reality? All it takes is to talk to people who have been drunk and to ask them what stupid things they've done while they're drunk. I've never been drunk. God has blessed me by preventing me from doing that. When I was young, I was not a Christian, but I was very involved in sports. And so, you know, all my friends were partiers, and I would go to the parties, but they knew that I was so involved in sports. You know, they'd ask me once, and I would say no, and that was it. But I saw them do some really stupid stuff, you know? And the next day, they'd say, "Oh, man, I can't believe I did this stupid stuff." And I'm like, "Well, what do you expect? You were drunk." Right? That's what alcohol does. I think if we were to go back in time to a couple days after chapter 1 and ask Ahasuerus if he was stupid in his actions, he'd probably say, "Yep." All because of the intoxication of a party. That's why it says in Ephesians chapter 5, verse 18, "And do not be drunk with wine, in which is dissipation." Dissipation means riotous, out of control living. "Be filled with the Spirit. We should not be controlled by anything but the Spirit of God." And as Baptists, we have as part of our covenant to abstain from the use of intoxicating drink. Now, although the Bible is clear that to have a drink now and again is not a sin, but I like the stance that Southern Baptists have in not drinking, because it does impart bad judgment. If you have been one of those who has been a fool because the negative influences of alcohol, put it away. And then number five, we see the sovereignty of God working through the decisions of men. This is a major theme in the whole book, and it begins here. Now, if you haven't read the book of Esther, and you're anticipating the great story, it is a great story, but here's a spoiler alert. You know how they have, like, when you're watching a trailer for a movie, and they say, "Spoiler alert, you know, we're going to tell you the ending"? I'm going to tell you the ending. So if you don't want to know the ending, you know, close your ears. But what happens is that Esther becomes queen. And Esther, as queen, is able to save her people from annihilation because of it. And so even though we look at this situation, we see Ahasuerus making a stupid decision because of intoxication, trying to show off to his people the beauty of his wife and the opulence of his possessions. Even though he made that stupid decision, that was a decision he made, God works in and through it all the while, bringing about the deliverance of his people through Esther. And so we see the sovereignty of God at work. How does God do this? Well, I don't know. I don't know how he works through our decisions to accomplish what he had planned all along. But the scriptures are clear that that's what happens. Proverbs chapter 16, verse 9, it says, "A man's heart plans his way, but the Lord directs his steps." Proverbs 16, verse 1, it says, "The preparation of a heart belongs to man, but the answer of the tongue is from the Lord." Proverbs 19, verse 21 says, "There are many plans in a man's heart, nevertheless the Lord's counsel that will stand." And we go on and on looking at various verses. Jeremiah chapter 10, verse 23 says, "O Lord, I know the way of man is not in himself. It is not in man who walks to direct his own steps." And so we see this idea that God is directing our steps, and yet we direct our own steps. How does that work? I don't know. God is at this very moment using your decisions to chart the course for the future that he has already mapped out for you. Isn't that incredible? I'm thankful he does this. Because It means that life is not meaningless, that your decisions are not meaningless, and that the future is not uncertain. Now, we've only begun to look at the story of Esther, and it will continue to be rich in plot and character development and everything else that makes for a great piece of literature. More than that, though, we will continue to be reminded that God is not absent from history or from the future, and He is at work through decisions of men to accomplish His will. And with that, we can give Him thanks and praise. Let's pray.
But just like the plant that withers away, we will leave many seeds behind. If today you lost your life, what would you leave behind? What would the ones around you see? What happened in the dash between your birth and death? What will you do to change your legacy? What will you do to change your legacy?